What is the difference between biblical justice and social justice? Are they the same? Two different worldviews? Is there overlap? Where should Christians fall down on the current debates about things like critical race theory? What does the Bible ask that Christians do for the cause of justice? We talk about that and much more on today's Theology on Air. Well, thanks for joining us today. I'm Evan McClanahan. I'm all by my lonesome in the studio today, the Theology on Tap Houston studio today. I'm the pastor at First Lutheran here in Houston. And Theology on Tap is a ministry in Houston where we get together young folks around craft beer every couple of months. We talk about interesting theological issues and, enjoy one another's fellowship in doing so. This is our weekly podcast that we put out, Theology on Air. And we talk about the same kinds of issues, but we have a lot more time to dig in. And so this is one of those issues, of course, that certainly in the last year in America has been on the top of folks' minds. There have been new books written. I'll just throw out one that comes to the top of my head, Vody Balcom's Fault Lines. I know Joel has written some about that, and I believe read it as well. But anyway, just as an example, we're not talking about that book today, but you know, many people are responding to kind of the race situation. We've got moms showing up to school boards all over America saying, quit teaching my kid critical race theory. So a lot really, even since we booked this this conversation, I think a lot has changed, you know, in how we talk about race, how we understand race. And so that's what we're talking about today. All those sorts of issues. I think we'll need to define some terms a little bit so that when we say social justice, we're kind of talking about the same thing and maybe find some points of agreement there as well. But with me today are two authors and thinkers, Scott Allen and Joel McDermott. Scott is the author of the book, Why Social Justice is Not Biblical Justice, An Urgent Appeal to Fellow Christians in a Time of Social Crisis. He's the president of Disciple Nations Alliance, a Christian discipleship ministry whose mission is to transform broken communities by equipping Christians with an empowered biblical worldview. And Joel McDermott is the former president for a number of years of American Vision, a theonomic ministry. He is currently in law school, putting his money where his mouth is, you might say, fighting for the cause of justice. And the most relevant book, I think he would agree, to this particular topic is his very deeply researched book, which I've read and he and I have talked about in the past, The Problem of Slavery in Christian America. And Joel, if it's okay to say, you can blog occasionally at a website and blog called Lamb's Reign. So I think people can find that Reign, R-E-I-G-H-N. No, R-E-I-G-N. I can't spell. All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining me. We'll do 10-minute openings. And if you want to include any more kind of biographical information or why this is important to you, feel free to do that. But Joel, we said that you would go first. As you're more in the affirmative on this position of this relationship between biblical and social justice. So take it away.
Well, thank you, Evan, and thank you to Scott for hosting. Thank you, Evan, for hosting this, and thank you to Scott for participating. I think it's a great forum, and I think it's a very important question. Is social justice biblical justice? And I argue yes, and the reason I say yes is because it's our duty to make it biblical justice. I want to start today a little bit, and I have a couple of affirmative points to make. But before I start those, I want to do something that probably few debate partners ever do, and that is I want to promote my debate partner's ministry. And that is, I spent some time on his website, and as far as what's written, as far as the mission and the belief statements and everything, I find myself shouting heartily, amen. This is the very type of thing I would want to be behind. If I was picking ministries to support, this would be one of them. And the reason for that is I think he shares with me a perspective that I would call transformationalism. And I don't know if he uses that word to describe himself, but I would. And some of the statements from here, I'm just going to read them, and I hope you don't mind beginning the debate this way. And that is the belief, number one, that Christ is king over everything presently, and that he seeks to extend his kingdom throughout every facet of the whole world through his body, the church. Quoting from the website, nations are discipled as the church makes the kingdom visible within its culture. Think about that. Within its culture, by faithfully obeying God's word in every area of life, every realm of society, including the family, community, arts, science, media, law, government, education, and business. So we agree on that, absolutely. We agree also that this kingdom is one in which the king calls for justice and righteousness to roll down like waters, to quote Amos 5:24. We agree, I think, that our role in this world is to transform the world. He says on the website, nations are discipled as local churches send their members into every sphere of society, acting as agents of transformation. Amen. The ministry of the local church, it continues, must be holistic, not just saving souls to get to heaven. It must minister to whole persons, physical, spiritual, social, and mental. Further, it must encompass their relationships with God and with others and with creation. I simply would assert further, and I think Mr. Allen would still agree, that in these goals, that these goals speak of something that is much larger than politics and government. A lot of times we talk about Christians getting involved in every area of life, and what we really just mean is please vote Republican this go-round, and or something of that nature. But these goals that he's talking about, arts, media, entertainment, culture, business, these are much more comprehensive of society, across society. They infuse society, and we're supposed to infuse society with the Spirit and have it come and glow from without it, if I can use a very weird metaphor. These goals are not merely political or governmental, they're social goals. I simply argue still further that in our comprehensive social transformative mission, we should also transform and redeem the inherently Christian label of social justice. It is an act of redemption and an act of transformationalism. We should, through our scholarship, through our words, and through our actions, define for the world what true social justice is according to the Bible. Social justice is simply one inquiry within the broader social discipline of social theory. I think Scott would also agree with me that social theory is an area of inquiry or of academic discipline that's been largely neglected by the church throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. It has been wholly set aside, and as churches and theologians look for ways to escape this world, or to set aside and, or get away from this world and run into a kind of Christian ghetto. But my argument would be that in the broader discipline of social theory, which the church really has not given us, and I would say especially among conservative biblical scholars, there are some liberal biblical scholars, and I think Scott and I would both disagree with them. The only conservative one that I know that's really dedicated his life to creating a social theory has been Gary North. Somebody may add Francis Schaeffer to that mix, but Schaeffer got a lot of inspiration. Social justice is just one inquiry within that broader inquiry. It is not, as I think Scott and many other people have claimed, a worldview in and of itself. It is simply a tool or a series of inquiries that need to be addressed within particular worldviews. And my argument is if we don't, as Christians, address it from a Christian worldview, then we will find ourselves watching as non-Christian worldviews pick up that mantle and run with it. And that's why we see, for example, that most of the social justice discussion that's out there is not Christian social justice. It's coming from a different perspective. It's not that it's a worldview in itself. It's simply that it's dominated by people who are of a different worldview. But I agree with Scott and his ministry on this aspect of transformationalism. We are to go out there and get involved and to transform as far as possible through the power of the Word and the Spirit, arts, media, entertainment, culture, business, government, education, all of those things. And I just simply add, why not the inquiry of social theory also, including social justice? And I think some people that are coming from Scott's perspective would say, well, look, this is something that's been dominated by Marxism from time immemorial. It's dominated by socialists. They're the ones driving these discussions. And some even conclude from that these are inherently socialist or Marxist discussions. And that's just simply not true. And in fact, there are many other areas we engage in ministry or in transformational ministry in which pagans still dominate. And that doesn't bother us from getting involved in it and working as much as we can to transform it from within the from the inside out. Look at science and medicine, biology and chemistry, and all of these areas utterly dominated by pagans who have a Darwinistic worldview. And all of the modern textbooks and all of the modern theories are completely written from a Darwinistic perspective. Does that stop us from getting in there? Do we say, oh, don't go into chemistry because that is dominated by Darwinists? Don't go into science or medicine because that is a Darwinistic field? We don't label it like that because we look at those as intellectual disciplines and also trades, if you will, unique skills that are in and of themselves work, and we all acknowledge that. And it's waiting for someone from a worldview to come along and give meaning to it. And it just so happens that in our culture, the pagans are the ones that dominate those fields. The same is true in geology, cosmology, mining, excavation, all forms of business are dominated by evolutionary perspectives. If you want to get involved in physics, you're going to learn about relativism. If you want to get involved in quantum physics, you're going to be dominated by an evolutionary worldview. And all of the theories are taught from the perspective of an evolutionary worldview. Does that mean quantum physics is this big boogeyman we have to back up and say, oh no, Christians shouldn't go here because it will corrupt your worldview? All of those areas, media, entertainment, business, whatever, banking, finance, all of them dominated by pagans and in many cases, pagan theories. But we don't back off. And pretend like they're a no touch, don't taste, don't touch, don't handle, as Paul said about the Pharisaical the legalistic Pharisees. My image that I appreciate more than anything in the New Testament is the image of Christ healing the leper, and I think that captures the mindset we need to have when we enter any of these areas, including social justice. Christ comes up, the leper comes up to him, wants to be healed, and Christ reaches out his hand and touches this leper. That was an absolute cultural and in fact, under the Mosaic law, legal no-no. If you touched a leper, his uncleanness flowed to you and made you unclean under the Old Testament law. And Jesus broke all those conventions, not because he was defying the law, but because in and of himself, he was the temple. He was the new creation. He was empowered by the Spirit. And so he could touch that which was unclean, and the power flowed out of him and cleansed the leper. And I think that's the calling of the New Testament church. After all, we're the Spirit-filled temple and body of Christ, his hands and feet on earth, if you will. And so it is nothing for us to step in the middle of a discussion or an academic discipline like social justice and say, I hear what you all are saying. I see there's problems here and there. I don't agree with you on this government solution. I don't agree with you with this aspect of it. Here's how I would address it, and have an ongoing discussion just like we do in every other field. And I think that's what we should do with social justice. Evan, I'm not real clear on how much time has elapsed and is left.
I've got 9 minutes, 40 seconds. So
okay,
kind of draw to a close.
I was doing pretty good. I will just say there's a lot of things to say about social justice. I want to squeeze this in before I quit. Social justice is simply how justice pertains to groups of people in time. And there are ways in the biblical law and biblical teaching in which that applies both to both through governmental actions in some cases and non-governmental actions in some cases. I always give the example that when slavery and Jim Crow were abolished legally, why did the racism persist? And that's because it was a heart and sin issue. Does that mean once the law was passed the next day, did all those people that ran those restaurants that forbid blacks from coming in, did they suddenly change in their hearts and minds and say, oh, okay, now guys, come on in. We welcome you. We love you. You're equals with us. No, they persisted. And God's law had a way of dealing with that. And it's not just the simple gospel things that say we're all equal in Christ. It goes to much more than that, that has to go from those definitional realities into social realities in places where the law can't reach. These are all questions of social justice and how we get there, not only through governmental action when appropriate, but also through social action, private and voluntary social action in many different ways. So I'll stop there in the interest of time, and hopefully we can have a fruitful discussion afterwards.
Great. Great. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for those opening thoughts. Scott, you got about 10 minutes as well. Maybe a little, maybe another minute in addition to that. So if you like.
Okay. Well, yeah, do give me a little thumbs up if I'm rambling on too long as well. But Joel, thanks for that opening statement. Evan, thanks for the opportunity to be with both of you today. Joel, thanks for the kind words about the ministry that God's called us into here at the DNA. So I really appreciate that. Appreciate you taking time to check out the website. And I'm so glad to hear that we, you know, are like-minded, it seems like, on a lot of these things. So that's wonderful. Appreciate that. So I'm going to take the negative position, I guess, on the question, is social justice biblical? And so let me explain that. Is social justice biblical? Not the way that these two words, social justice, are understood in the broader culture today. And you could take any number of examples. For example, I was thinking about Nike. Since I'm here in Oregon, one of the biggest companies here in Oregon, but you could look at any number of companies, government agencies, schools, universities. They all purportedly stand for social justice. That phrase has become, or that couplet has become, just dominant in the society. In 2020, Nike donated hundreds of millions of dollars to groups like Black Lives Matter and other organizations, quote, dedicated, this is from their mission statement, to ensuring racial equity and social justice. So then the question is, what do these companies, universities, schools, agencies, celebrities, and on, what do they mean by social justice? Because their understanding is establishing the mainstream cultural understanding of that couplet, social justice. And while there isn't one kind of uniform written definition of what social justice is, in my own studies on this, in the broader culture, I found that there's a lot of commonality to this mainstream cultural understanding. And in my book, I boil it down this way. I say, the social justice, as it is understood commonly in the broader culture, is deconstructing systems and structures that are deemed to be oppressive and redistributing power and resources from oppressors to their victims in the pursuit of equity, by which they mean equality of outcome. In my book, I contrast this with how the Bible speaks about the concept of justice. Justice is a word, obviously, that's used pervasively in the Bible. It describes God's very character. So it's very important for Christians to understand what this word means. And it's a huge concept. It's not easy to boil down to its essence, but I do attempt to do that in the book. And let me share with you that attempt. I put it this way. Justice is conformity to God's moral standard as it is revealed in the Ten Commandments and the royal law, love your neighbor as yourself. It entails living in right relationship with God and with others. It entails giving people their due as image bearers of God. And it also describes the work of God and of God-ordained authorities in impartially rendering judgment, in righting wrongs and meting out punishment for law-breaking. God-ordained authorities include parents in the home, teachers in schools, elders in churches, and civil authorities in the state. That's quite a mouthful there. But what I want you to do is just pay attention to how different these two understandings are. They both use the word justice, but they mean entirely different things by them. As a colleague of ours, John Stonestreet, is fond of saying, it's no good using the same word if we're relying on different dictionaries. So here I'm talking about justice, but then what about this couplet, social justice? Is social justice just another way of describing biblical justice? Well, in the research that I've done, and granted, I haven't done a ton of research on this, but I have done some looking into it. The couplet social justice never appears in the Bible. Rather, you trace its origins back to the 1840s and to an Italian Jesuit scholar named Luigi Taparelli di Esiglio. And he was writing at a time, you know, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the beginnings of the study of social theory or sociology. And he was extending some of these biblical ideas of justice into kind of this understanding of society as a whole. Then, until the early 1970s, the phrase social justice was really used almost entirely by Catholics or other Christian scholars or organizations. And it became part of the official Roman Catholic Church doctrine. But around 1970 and onward, that couplet social justice was picked up by atheistic Marxist-influenced scholars, and it was put in service to describe their basic worldview assumptions on this subject. And since the Second World War, social justice has really come to mean something entirely different from what its Catholic originators meant when they used that couplet there, social justice. Today, social justice, when it's used in the broader culture by companies like Nike and universities and our federal government, is based on typically the following presuppositions. And to me, these are worldview presuppositions. First, there is no God, there's no objective truth, there's no objective morality. Reality is socially constructed. It's reduced to a zero-sum competition for power, control, and domination between various social groups. Second presupposition, human beings are at root evolved social beings. We're the product of social groups that we belong to, particularly groups based on race, sex, or gender identity. Third, the world is divided into oppressors and oppressed. Nothing exists outside these categories. Oppressors are morally evil. Oppressed victims are morally innocent. Fourth, at present, white heterosexual males are oppressors. Everyone else is oppressed by them to one degree or another. Over the centuries, this oppressor group has established an elaborate web of social systems and structures, norms and narratives to advantage or privilege themselves at the expense of everyone else. Fifth, proof of the existence of this systemic oppression is found in group disparities. So, for example, if white students have a higher per capita SAT score than Black students, that disparity is necessary proof that our educational systems are systemically racist. Ibram X. Kendi, the great popularizer of kind of social justice and anti-racism in the culture today, articulates this presupposition with great clarity. He says, when I see racial disparities, I see racism. And this same thing applies to disparities between sexes or any disparity between so-called oppressors and oppressed groups. Sixth, to be woke is to be conscious or aware of this vast, often hidden array of systemic structural oppression. And then to fight for social justice is to engage in the efforts to deconstruct, expose, and dismantle these oppressive systems and structures, and ultimately to eliminate group disparities in this kind of utopian pursuit of equality of outcome. Today, this atheistic or Marxian conception of social justice really has won out. It's carried the field, if you will, in the broader culture. It's where we find ourselves today. So then the question is, what should we as Christians do about it? Should we fight to reclaim this older Catholic understanding of social justice? I'm not particularly strongly opposed to that idea, but I'm actually not a big fan of it either. And let me share with you why I don't feel like it's something that we need to fight for. First of all, that couplet, social justice, again, has only been around since the 1800s. It has roots in Jesuit teaching. I'm obviously not a Jesuit or a Catholic, although I have many Catholic friends. And then, you know, it quickly picked up Marxist baggage. It became associated with liberation theology quite early on. So I'm not particularly invested, I guess, personally in upholding and defending this relatively modern conception of social justice. That said, we absolutely have to defend justice. Okay, that's a deeply biblical word, deeply biblical concept. In fact, its origins are traced to the Bible, to the Judeo-Christian tradition, going back more than 4,000 years. Secondly, because what the broader culture means by social justice today is so very different than what Christians mean by it, here referring to these earlier Christian understandings, it simply creates confusion when we as Christians talk about our commitment to social justice. So if a Christian says, hey, I stand for social justice, but they don't define their terms, they're going to be understood in the broader culture to be affirming these presuppositions that I just talked about. In order to avoid this, they have to say something like, I stand for social justice, but not in the way that it's understood in the broader culture. By this, I mean dot, dot, dot. And all this to me just simply creates a lot of confusion. To avoid this confusion and to bring clarity, I prefer simply to say that I stand for justice or biblical justice, that is, justice as it is understood from the scriptures in Judeo-Christian tradition. Thirdly,
we're at about 11 minutes.
So maybe, oh, my goodness. Okay.
All right. Don't worry about it.
Okay. Well, let me wrap up here then. Yeah, I'll just simply say that I don't think that the evangelical church right now is in a position to be kind of imposing a particular or influencing the broader culture with a particular version of social justice. I think the problem is just the opposite. This kind of secularized understanding of social justice is really rapidly coming into our churches. And this is really the problem I think we need to address in the churches right now. We've got to stand for biblical justice, and the confusion that we're facing is around this phrase social justice.
Yeah, and I'm reminded the SBC is meeting, and of course this is a huge issue. Well, critical race theory, you might mm-hmm. say, which is wrapped up in all this. But anyway, I don't know if they've elected a new president or not, but. Basically, as I have read things, it's like, just as an example to your last point, Scott, that the politicking is going on sort of around all these issues and kind of where you stand and where we want the SBC to go. So it is very much at the heart of Christian life. So Joel, about 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Sure. And I'm going to try to be pretty terse on this. At least stick to the points. As far as his definitions of social justice, and how the broader mainstream culture is understanding it. And by the way, what you're doing there, when you say the mainstream culture sees it this way, and we have to make a decision of whether we're going to confront that or whether we're going to abide by it for the time being or whatever, what you're saying there is that there's a cultural hegemony that you have to deal with. So we're all being critical theorists at some point. And my point is, let's just embrace the fact of what they're doing. But I want to get into some of these points. The first one being this idea that there's no objective truth in social justice. And by the way, I think what you're doing is Scott is taking some categories from the critical race discussion and bringing them into the broader social justice discussion. And those are, I think they're separate inquiries. I'm not sure they overlap 100% like that, but I will address them as I hear them. In either one, social justice or critical theory, critical race theory, you keep hearing this from Scott and many other people that there's no objective truth. There's pure subjective, you know, the truth is now internal, personal, subjective. It's a product of human imagination, and that it's also based on Marxist or atheistic presuppositions. And I would say that's infused in a lot of the popular practice. In his book, Scott quotes from Francis Schaeffer saying that these two worldviews are different, and that they will inevitably produce totally different results. And I'm just saying that's not the case because people are not consistent in applying their worldviews. If they're doing something within their worldview that's actually got some kind of biblical cachet, we need to latch onto that and start directing that conversation, or at least using it in a biblical way, and forget their presuppositions. They're not being consistent with that. And in fact, if you know anything about worldviews at all, you know that a humanist can never be fully consistent with their presupposition, or they would just cease to exist. They would run into oblivion. It wouldn't make sense. But I also see that Scott and many other people like him that are criticizing this are not consistent in this regard, because throughout Scott's own book, he quotes from James A. Lindsay, who's a vociferous critic of critical race theory and social justice, who himself is also a vociferous atheist and Darwinist and all those other things. So if it's good in that case, why can't we do the same thing within the social justice inquiry? The same thing when people like Scott and others quote from Jordan Peterson quite properly. Well, Jordan Peterson is a Jungian psychologist. He's a humanist. And we might say, well, yeah, but a lot of what he teaches overlaps with what my values are. And I'm trying to get people to realize that if you really listen to what critical race theorists are teaching and social justice people are teaching, you'll realize that we overlap there a lot too. And we need to treat them in the same way we treat our conservative heroes who are not believers. When it comes to the claim about human identity, the claim is again, from the book, creatures, social justice teaches that human beings are creatures whose identity are wholly determined by group affiliations. There is no such thing as the individual. That's just not true. There's not a single critical race theorist, social justice warrior in the history of the world who's ever taught that. Anywhere. Nobody has said that you're wholly defined by your group affiliation. Nobody said individuality ceases to exist and that our identity is entirely social constructed. The claim from the critical race theorist is that we're influenced by our cultures. And if you don't believe that, just look at what you would say if someone tries to pin the beliefs of John Calvin on you and the reformers of the 15th, 16th century who killed blasphemers. And we all look back on that and say, well, they're Christians. They were just people of their time. Why do we say that? Because we believe people are conditioned by their culture, even if they're Christians in some cases. And we could give more examples of that as well. When it comes to moral duty, there's a claim in the book I'd really love to address. I don't think I have time. There's a claim about standpoint epistemology that the greater a group's experience of intersectional oppression, the greater its members' insight into reality. Objective truth, reason, logic, evidence, and argument are viewed as weapons employed by oppressors to maintain their hegemony. That's not what the claim of standpoint epistemology is. It's simply saying that if you grew up in an oppressed race class, you're going to have a little different insight into the world than somebody who's never experienced that. If you grew up like me, largely white, suburban, and insulated from the realities of the ghetto, you may not think that police harassment of Black people is as big a problem as somebody who grew up with it and experiences with it. And matter of fact, I know plenty of people now who said, yeah, I mean, I can't even sit in a car along the side of a road in my old neighborhood without the cops stopping by and starting up a discussion and trying to find a pretext. Why? Black man in a car, that's why. But that's not what standpoint epistemology is about. And I'm afraid that with Scott and many other people who've taken these popular criticisms of social justice and critical theory, and they've extracted them from a context, they've absolutized them, and they've turned them into really what is kind of a boogeyman. And I would say from a philosophical point, a straw man. And yeah, you can find a statement here or there that sounds like it, and in some cases gets very close to it. But then we need to ask the question, do we want to be characterized in that way? Or do we want the lone radical expression among us to be the person that represents us? And we would say, no, we don't want the Westboro Baptists to be the representatives for all Christians. We don't think that's fair. And I would simply say, well, let's not do that to the critical theorists either. They have a very large, rich, detailed, and complex body of thought. And I just don't see it portrayed fairly. And in fact, in Scott's book, I read it 250 pages. In that whole body of work, there's barely any quotation from source material. It's all defined by the critics. Well, let me ask you a question. If you wanted someone to represent what your Christian faith is about, would you go to Richard Dawkins to do that for you? Would you go to a Sam Harris or the late Christopher Hitchens and say, here, why don't you stand up in my place and tell people what my Christian faith is about? Well, no, you'd get the most distorted, ugly account of it possible because his job is to demonize it. Critical race theory and social justice, and most of the ones quoted in Scott's book, are doing the same thing to critical theory from different perspectives. And I say, we just got to back up. We got to have a much fairer, much more open conversation about the source material and what they're really trying to say. And when you do, I think you'll find out there's a tremendous area of overlap in which we can work. And like I said, there's so much to say on this in this regard. I do like the fact that Scott agrees that race is a social construction. I think that's a good launching point for some really good conversation going forth. So anyway, I suppose you said I was out of time.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. We went over. So Scott, if you want a couple minutes in addition to the five as well. And just as a reminder, this is really a rebuttal of going all the way back to Joel's first, you know, first comments, but it's your time. So you can also talk about whatever you like as well, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, yeah, maybe I can pick up, you know, several things I could say, I guess, in response. I, you know, Joel, you're accusing me of trying to create a straw man. I can genuinely say that I'm not. I set out to write the book mainly because I was seeing these ideas that are very powerful in the culture right now, really dominating our culture in many ways, being picked up by dear Christian friends that I deeply respect. And parroted, they filtered them, these ideas have filtered down and were being understood and articulated by Christians who may have no understanding of some of these original source materials of critical theorists that you were talking about.
Yep.
But as I listened to them, I was very alarmed. I felt like these ideas were leading them away from the truth as you know, as brothers and sisters in Christ. It became very alarming to me. So I guess my concern was to what are these ideas, not just in terms of how they were articulated maybe by theorists in the academy, but how they're actually being understood in the culture, how they're manifesting themselves and bearing fruit in the culture today around us, and particularly in the church. And to my own research on this, you know, I read a lot from popularizers. These would be people like Ibram X. Kendi. I read a ton from Ta-Nehisi Coates. These are not critics of social theory. These are popularizers. These are people deeply shaped by these ideas. Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility. I've read a lot of these books that are really the ones that are sourced or pointed to in, you know, the way that most people experience this in their daily lives would be things like diversity, inclusion, and equity trainings. Well, they're pointing to these kind of popularizers. So I was really trying to understand, what are they saying? You know, their ideas, they didn't just pull them out of thin air, right? You know, ideas have consequences, but they also have antecedents. And I think when you go back and you do a little bit of digging and tracing, you find that the antecedents for these ideas really are from the continental tradition, continental philosophical tradition. You can trace them back to philosophers like Kant, Hegel, Nietzsche. And it was from that theological or that philosophical tradition, that continental tradition, which was atheistic. The postmodernism and Marxism both emerged kind of from that soil. When you know, get to social justice as it's understood today as a label, you have to look at people very closely, like Antonio Gramsci, who was an atheist, who was a Marxist, and, you know, many of these people in the Frankfurt School, these social theorists as well, and postmodernists like Foucault. So they're definitely not Christians. They're definitely not operating from a biblical worldview. Is that to say that all of their ideas, 100% of them, are completely false? No. All truth is God's truth, right? So, but their starting point is completely different. And because of that, it goes in a completely different direction. And I would say, you know, you made the point, are people consistent with their worldviews? And I would agree that people aren't consistent. And yet, worldviews are stories, right? And these stories hang together, right? So, you know, we tend to live within our stories, and this tells a particular story. It's a story about how, frankly, there isn't a God. We are socially conditioned beings. We're defined by, you know, you made the point that of kind of challenging what I was saying about the individual. And let me clarify that. This worldview says that what mostly defines you isn't the fact that you're made by God in his image, but that you're shaped by your sociology and particularly by things like skin color or sex or gender. That's kind of how you are defined. So, you know, what happens is that the individual, the person as an individual with unique history kind of vanishes. And where you see this, I think, is particularly is in this phrase, white privilege, right? I can know all that really is important about you, whether you're privileged or not, based on one thing and one thing only, your skin color. That defines you. You know, I was thinking about Ayanna Pressley, the congresswoman from Massachusetts, who I think it was at Netroots Nation. She said, you know, we don't need any more black voices, black faces who don't want to be black voices. We don't need any more queers who don't want to be queer voices. In other words, unless you get in line with this kind of group identity and this group voice, you're not wanted. You're not wanted as an individual. That's what, you know, that's what I mean by when I say the individual kind of disappears within this worldview. You're expected to think, act, and function, or we can know everything that it's important to know about you based on immutable characteristics like skin color and sex. Yeah, and I think your description of standpoint epistemology is not quite, you know, it's not quite correct. It doesn't mean simply that, you know, we have different perspectives or life experiences that shape our views of things. I certainly would agree with that. It goes much deeper than that. You know, it's this idea that if you're not a quote unquote victim, you simply cannot understand, and therefore you need to remain silent. You need to, your viewpoint isn't valid. It's not correct. I think of this confrontation that we saw several years ago at Yale University with the students and Professor Christakis. And at one point, you know, one of the black students got up in his face, and Christakis is a white man, he's a Jew. And he said, the black student said to him, your experience will never connect to mine because I'm black and you're white and our experiences are so utterly different. There isn't a common human nature that that unites us. There's nothing that unites us. You know, this is kind of the idea behind so much of this kind of way that these ideas of critical social theory are working themselves out in the broader culture today. So,
okay,
I'll just end with that.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys for the opening remarks and rebuttal so far. I think we're off to a great start. I do want to emphasize, you know, that we are all Christians here. And even I think more you two is important than me, but, you know, in the Reformed tradition generally, that would affirm the importance of the scriptures and so on and so forth. So we should share very similar worldviews. And hopefully that will make for this to be the best conversation it can be, because we want to see kind of exactly where that point of diversion is. So I have an opening question for both of you, and then I've got some other topics maybe we can come back to, but we'll see how it goes. I think that y'all will probably want to talk about certain things as well. But so because I want to get it really kind of where the conflict is or where the difference is, my question to you, Joel, would be, what is the common ground? We haven't quite said it quite yet, I don't think. Like, what would be the common ground between those advocating for social justice and those who, as Christians, believe in biblical justice? So maybe give some examples of that. It could be even somewhat pithy. But then, Scott, my question for you would be, what really is the gospel conflict, like the Galatians level, DEFCON 5, this is a real departure, you know, from Christianity. This is a kind of threat in a way to Christianity. So what's the conflict, Scott? But Joel, maybe you go first. What is the common ground on these phrases, biblical justice and social justice, and those who propose them?
Yeah, I mean, the social justice is such, like Scott said earlier, it's undefined. It's very undefined in its usage in the world. And that makes it a very broad category. So you can enter through any door you want to. And my point is not to go to them so much and try to find those points of common ground as it is to say, start saying what we think it should be and then start acting it out. And I think when you start bringing justice solutions in society that do solve the problems that exist, whether it's homelessness, poverty, where there is inequality, for example, and, you know, whether you want to attribute that to racial racism or not, if you go in and solve the inequality so that there's not racial disparity, nobody's going to complain, and they're going to look at you and say, wow, your version of social justice solved the problem. I know that's oversimplifying. That's how I look at it. And I think Christians need to be involved, like on the ground, gathering data, talking to people, absolutely listening to other perspectives, listening to the people who have suffered, completely reevaluating the criminal justice system, for example, when it comes to how we treat drug addicts and drug possession and a whole variety of other things, how we punish people. I mean, why the Bible gives us a whole biblical law full of justice solutions, penalties, punishments for different types of crimes. It nowhere mentions prison or even police forces at all. How did they do it? The pagan nations around them had prisons and police forces. How did God expect his people to get by without it? There were drunkards and drug addicts in that society also, not quite as bad as we have, of course, because of the way we refine drugs. But, you know, these are launching points for discussion. And I found that as I engage in those discussions, my solutions start grabbing the attention in the group of the liberals who are there, who aren't trying to say, you don't get to talk because you're white. I know that happens in some extreme examples, and I think it's telling that the example that's given is of a student in a highly charged forum, and people are emotional. Well, you know, we don't let students run the legislature for a reason. You know, we need to have these discussions as adult conversations and hash them out. But I find that those people gravitate toward me, and it's not because we share same presuppositions, it's because we have the same goals in society. And I find them telling me, you know, you're the first Christian I've ever listened to. You're the first Christian I've ever wanted, that's ever made me want to study the Bible, because I have these types of discussions. And that's the truth. Like the entire body of critical theory, again, it's not a worldview. It is a small snippet that takes place within a worldview. It's really the discipline of sociology and one application of it in legal studies and a couple other places. And what happens is the reason it seems like relativism and that there's no objectivity is because the people admit we're people acting in history, and we admit that we have biases also, and we're acknowledging that you have biases, and we're not going to, when they say we don't believe in objectivity, what they mean is we don't believe in your claim to objectivity, because we've got a whole history to look at where white people claimed this was the objective truth, that black people were inferior, and then, well, it was okay, black people need to be separate but evil, God doesn't want us mixing, and all, there's always this objective truth. It's objective, it's objective, and it's even divine. And it got to the point where the Marxist tradition said, no, let's just see what we can learn from studying history, and let's see how we can apply that in real action in real time. And do you blame them? Do you blame the black people after all that history? But anyway, you asked me a separate question, and I can feel myself digressing. What is the common ground? I think the common ground is when you get in and actually address real problems, that you will get their attention. And I think as you're able to do that successfully, I have a tremendous idea that's already been established in Italy when it comes to drug addiction treatment. It's revolutionary, and it ought to be all over the world, but it's not. We could totally transform society as a whole from this one thing. And it's from my perspective, it's a biblical solution, even though they don't call it that. And I'm thinking, if we can just have this one thing, you're going to get the attention of a lot of people. And when you say, yeah, this is biblical social justice or biblical justice, they're going to start listening a lot more, and those other discussions will fade away. And I, honestly, if I can just extend this just a little bit more, I don't want to hog the time, but I was reading, here's a copy of the essay, Demarginalizing the Intersection of Race and Sex. This is the landmark article that was written by Kimberly Crenshaw that started the whole intersectionality discussion. And she's credited as kind of the godmother of this movement. And there's a couple things she says in here about what she's trying to do that show that will give you the answer to the question. Here's common ground. She's talking about how people tried to solve racism through passing laws. And she said, if their efforts had instead began with addressing the needs and problems of those who were most disadvantaged, and with restructuring and making the world where necessary, then others who are singularly disadvantaged would also benefit. In addition, it seems that placing those who are currently marginalized in the center is the most effective way to resist efforts at to compartmentalize experiences and undermine collective action. The last part of this, and I'd love to read it all, but just for the interest of time, I skipped to the last sentence. The goal of this activity should be to facilitate the inclusion of marginalized groups for whom it can be said, when they enter, we all enter. I don't know if you can hear the echo of God's prophets and the treating of the poor and the widow and the orphan in that language, but that's exactly what she's trying to do. And that's all she was trying to do in that article, was to say, look, we've passed laws against Black discriminating on race. We've also passed laws about discriminating against sex. But it just so happens that the phenomenon that was meant to curtail lets specifically Black women fall through the gap. And we can show that statistically, and there are court cases that claim it. However, the court could say, well, I'm sorry, when you look at the law, the on board and the case at hand, the company is not discriminating against women because women are not being disproportionately affected. However, it just so happened that all the women that were going through were white women, and race is not being discriminated against because Black people are not being disproportionately treated. It just so happened that they were all Black males. And when you look at this, and so the court says, I'm sorry, our hands are tied. There's no specific category in the law for Black females. And Kimberly Crenshaw was simply pointing this out in multiple cases and in multiple social settings since then, that Black women suffer this disparity over and over and over and over again. And the laws that we've passed to protect from discrimination don't, because the categories just don't overlap enough to help them out. And maybe that's not as clear as I would hope for it to be. But she wasn't trying to say, well, these people are more oppressed, so they understand the world better and you need to be quiet. But she is saying, you know what? They seem to be statistically more marginalized than everyone else. And we need to have a policy that starts with that lowest level and helps them, because when we help them, we'll help everybody. Okay. And that's the kind of thinking that gets done. If we can approach that from a biblical perspective, you're not going to have to worry about where's the common ground, because that is the common ground, solving the actual problems in history.
All right. I didn't want to interrupt that. So Scott, I want you to have equal time on the same question. And if you want to answer a different question or go in a different direction, that's fine too. But my question to you, what really is the conflict, since you, I think, do see, you know, more of a conflict between.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, let me pick up just where Joel left off, because, you know, my whole career has been involved with Christian relief and development. I worked for 20 years with Food for the Hungry and have been very concerned about poverty and how do we help impoverished communities to rise out of poverty and begin to flourish. So we certainly have that common heart for justice. I think one of the problems that I have, this is to getting to your question, Evan, one of the problems I have with critical social theory is that it looks at marginalized people, let's say, impoverished people or Black people. And by the way, it doesn't limit, you know, its understanding of marginalized people to those categories. Transgender people are marginalized, so are, you know, gays and lesbians and things like that. So, but it starts with them, and it says the reason that you're poor, marginalized, you know, all of these negative things that disproportionately are part of what's going on in your experience as a group, it says it's because of bigotry of one form or another. It limits its analysis to that and that alone. And that is really, if you care about really helping people arise out of poverty or brokenness, you have to really say, well, it's not good just to limit our understanding to one thing or two things. You have to really get at what's going on. You know, if There are more blacks as a percentage of the population in prison than whites. Is that because the prison system and our criminal justice system is inherently structurally racist? Well, let's look at that, but let's not limit our analysis to that either. There may be other reasons why crime rates are higher and things like that. So Joel and I do fundamentally disagree on this point about worldview, though. And I do see it again. And I think this is another difference between Joel and I. It seems like Joel's interested in kind of the academic theory. I'm much more interested in how it's playing itself out in the culture, you know, in the way, in a way that it's that people are bumping up against in curriculum in public schools, in inclusion, diversity, and equity training that's being required of them, you know, in Black Lives Matter and riots and things that are happening in Portland and these kinds of things. You know, these are people that probably have never studied Kimberly Crenshaw, but they're certainly being influenced by her ideas, right? So I'm much more interested in that because I think that's where these ideas are really hitting the road and bearing the fruit. I do see it as a worldview. I don't think that, to me, it's very clear. It's a worldview in the sense that it answers people's big questions. What is ultimately real? Who am I? Why is there brokenness in the world? What's wrong with the world and how can it be made right again? And the answers that it provides to those big worldview questions are very different than what we get from the scriptures. And this is really where I see it as being a huge problem. So for example, what's wrong with the world? It would boil the answer to that question down to social problems of one form or another, right? It's going to be social structures, systemic issues of one form or another. The Bible is going to say, yeah, those things are real. We do have problems in society. We can have structural oppression, things like that. Doesn't deny that, but it roots it in a broken human heart. And I always, I love the famous quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, you know, that the line between good and evil doesn't flow between political parties and, you know, it doesn't flow between, if you will, races or sexes. It runs right through every human heart. So the biblical worldview goes very deep in its understanding of brokenness. It says we're sinful, rebellious creatures, and we've all broken God's law. And therefore, the solution is different for people that kind of limit their understanding to critical social justice categories. The solution is always some kind of social or structural problem. A solution, you know, if you listen to Ibram X. Kendi, it's got to be, we've got to essentially now discriminate against white people for past discrimination against black people. We've got to set up systems that do that. So, but the Bible has a very different solution. It says, you know, that the ultimate solution to the brokenness in the world is Jesus Christ dying on the cross for your sins. It's the gospel message. And as people come to faith in Christ, they are born again. There's this miracle of regeneration that happens, and they begin to see the world. They have a new heart and begin to see the world in a new way. And all that internal regeneration is then supposed to work its way outward into society, right, into families and into our nations as well. But it doesn't begin with kind of social or societal structures. It begins with, you know, the regeneration of human hearts. I would simply say another thing too, in terms of my big concerns about this ideology, if you will. I think it is divisive by design because it roots our human nature, our human character, primarily in immutable things like skin color, sex, gender identity. And then it kind of overlays on top of that this assumption that you're either in an oppressor or an oppressed group. It works its way out in terms of just social conflict, right? And it's a great departure in this respect from the civil rights movement of the 1950s and from Martin Luther King Jr. He wasn't interested in kind of making judgments on people based on skin color. He wanted his children to be judged by the content of their character. You know, that's been largely abandoned by this new movement, which wants to make kind of skin color, things like that, the kind of the bedrock of identity. And we can make judgments about you and whatnot based on those kinds of things. Well, what that leads to is just where King's movement brought unity, this one just fragments people. It just it has nothing to do with racial unity. It's just exacerbating, you know, racial tension. I mean, as this ideology works its way out into culture and society, that's what we're seeing. So it's very dangerous.
Let me jump in. I want to touch on something that's come up already, you know, a lot, quite a bit, a lot already. But really this oppressed oppressor. So I think if your average person sort of is starting to get familiar with concepts of like critical theory, cultural Marxism, which is kind of the, I think it's safe to say it's kind of the philosophy that was behind what we called social justice for a long time. And again, a lot of what we're talking about, I think, is to a degree of, you know, there's a way in which we could describe social justice that we would all agree is good and right and proper. But then there's, I think Scott is saying there's more sort of popular understanding of that phrase that is backloaded with some of these ideas. But I'd like to kind of key in on that sense of like oppressor, oppressed. I mean, for example, God, in a certain manner of speaking, certainly is the champion of the oppressed. We think like the Magnificat, for example, right? The rich are sent away empty and the poor are lifted up. But at what point does an understanding of oppressed oppressor, at what point is it biblical, and at what, and when does it go off the rails? When is it no longer biblical? I think that is something that really matters, because I think I can hear Joel saying, hey, we really need to understand oppressed oppressor because that's biblical. And I think Scott is saying, if that's the only lens by which we see things, we're putting people into categories that is not biblical, because God is not a respecter of persons, for example. So we need to look beyond categories. So maybe, Joel, what do you, and try to keep it short. I'm not keeping time anymore, but I do want there to be some back and forth. So oppressor,
and there's so much that I would want to respond to, but the whole concept of these oppressor and oppressed groups and victim groups, again, is one of the vast exaggerations of the critics of critical theory. Yes, it does use that language. And unfortunately, there are some people in popular society that apply it that way. But then again, what are you going to use for your standard of judgment? Are you going to allow the same to be true of popular expressions of Christianity that make the news and are extreme? No, we don't judge that way. But who's oppressed? Who's an oppressor? Just because someone is oppressed and someone belongs to an oppressor group does not mean that there is this connection in the theory that there's some kind of individual bigotry going along. As Scott said a while ago, that and that alone is the criteria by which they judge. And it's simply not. Again, going back to the thing that we agree on, that race is a social construct, it is absolutely not what's been called an essentialist theory, or the old theory of race that is something inherent in your person, your character, your skin color. It is something that has to do with how society has grown up and changed over time, that at one time these things were built into the laws. Those categories were constructed with the laws, and they shaped how all of us thought. You know, what did you say? Something about how we need to change hearts and minds first. Can you imagine saying that in 1950 Mobile, Alabama, when blacks were oppressed, when they couldn't congregate? Could you imagine saying that in 1850 Birmingham, Alabama, when blacks were enslaved, when they weren't allowed to read, when they were whipped, when their families were torn apart, when all of the atrocities we know with slavery? Can you imagine going to them and say, you know, we can't really do anything about this socially, structurally, until we change all the hearts and minds first? No, and that's the sad fact about it. It would be great. I think you said that's the way it's supposed to work. I agree with that. That's the way it's supposed to work, but it rarely does work that way. And that's why we need to be advocates in society. We need to be advocate for changing laws where necessary and changing cultural practices and ideas and norms where necessary. Can, again, imagine yourself saying, we need to change all the hearts and minds in 1950 Alabama before we can desegregate and end the Jim Crow laws. That's the very thing Dr. King said when he was sitting in jail in Birmingham. In his letter, he says, they keep telling us, just wait a little longer, a little longer. And it never happens. It never happens because, and I'll tell you why it never happens, is because the people in the pulpits are not preaching against it the way they should be. They're too bad cowering. Oh, that people that are preaching against racism, they're Marxists. They're wanting to bring communism in here. That's exactly what they said in 1950 and 60 Alabama. We've got to knee-jerk against this and build a wall to protect ourselves from this incoming theory. In the meantime, Dr. King sitting in jail, being told, wait, wait, wait. It doesn't work that way. We need to be in the streets. We need to be joining hands with people on issues, on particular problems, and working on those problems. And if you can't change the hearts and the minds before you change the problems, I'm just going to have to say I'm kind of fine with that, because God brings social change in many ways. And just as he told the Jews in the first century, I'm going to speak to you the gospel through lips that you can't understand, which he meant was the bringing in of the Gentiles and the breaking down of those racial barriers. And we need to have the same mentality today. Sometimes bringing these godly transformations in life means listening to the pagans who've worked in that area first, listening and maybe working with them. And the changing of hearts and minds often comes in hindsight, unfortunately. So I probably strayed way away from your question, but that's how I feel about the matter. I think we need to have that as our focus.
Okay. Scott, I was asking about oppressed oppressor.
Oppression, right? I can answer that really simply. I think that, Joel, listen, it's both and, okay? It's both and. We need the gospel. People need internal heart and mind change that can only happen through faith in Jesus Christ. And then our social systems need to change. It's both and.
Well, then you agree. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. Sorry.
Yeah, we agree. But the problem with you saying, I think you're overemphasizing the societal change. And when Christians have done that, this is what the liberal mainstream church did in the 1900s with the social gospel. Eventually, the gospel gets, it just goes away. It's not important anymore. That's something we have to be very careful about. So the gospel has to remain at the very center of any kind of theory of Christian social change. It just has to. And so I want to be a little cautious about what you're saying, because I hear your passion, but at the same time, the gospel's got, there is no changing this world apart from changing people, broken, sinful people. They need to be reborn. So I think we would agree with that. Oppression. Evan, the Bible talks a lot about oppression. It typically looks something like the parable of the Good Samaritan, the man who was beaten up, stripped, and left to die alongside of the road. It's people that are in power or have the ability to use their power to beat up somebody and steal their money. And that might be an individual or it might be a government that is doing that. It's using power in this unjust way for personal gain of one sort or another. That would be oppression biblically. The Bible stands against that full stop. Critical social justice, when it talks about oppression, it means often something very different. Not that there's not some overlap here, but like take the case of, transgenderism. It would say that the male-female binary that comes to us from the Judeo-Christian tradition, from the Bible, that's oppressive. That's oppressive to transgender people. It needs to be deconstructed. Gays and lesbians would say that male-female marriage is oppressive. That's an oppressive idea to gays and lesbians, right? So, they would say things like, you're an oppressor simply based on your skin color, right? If you're white, you're oppressor. You're part of the oppressor category. You need to pay. You need to pay reparations or whatever it is because of your skin color. So, it's going to base its sense of oppression or oppressor based on these immutable characteristics and then it's going to extend it into very unchristian ideas as well. So,
yeah. Let's see if I did not mute myself. Let's say we have about 20 minutes, and you guys, I think I said 5 minute closing. So I do want to save some time for that. There are so many issues to get at, but let me ask a couple more. How does the Bible inform that we think about groups versus individuals? One of the things when I read the Old Testament is that it does seem that the individual has certain judicial rights, that may not be the right word, but he has a right to have witnesses, to show that he is guilty. I don't know that presumed innocent is a biblical phrase in the Old Testament, but we derive that right, I think, from Old Testament law. So there does seem to be a strong biblical favor towards the individual and some certain inherent or inalienable rights, you might say. Whereas I think one of the critiques of some of the social justice or CRT movements, et cetera, critical theory movements, et cetera, is that it does overemphasize the guilt of collective groups or the, you know, certain people. So I'm curious what y'all think the just some examples or the biblical teaching on the guilt of groups and the rights of individuals. What is the balance of that? You know, I'm not trying to push it toward one way or another, but Joel, I mean, would you agree that in the Old Testament you do see in the New Testament as well, but that the person is guilty? There's a value of the individual to a degree that they have certain rights when accused of a crime, for example?
Absolutely. The Bible is the foundation of most of the individual rights we've enshrined in our constitutional system. And you can go back and prove that historically, the Fifth Amendment, Fourth Amendment, everything. So certainly the concept of having two witnesses to prove your individual guilt in a court case is a biblical right. I would not be afraid to call it that at all. Your question is, how does that play when we deal with groups?
Well, and I think, yeah, because I think one of the issues is what Scott would say is that whiteness, and again, there might be an academic way of talking about this that makes sense, you know, talking about whiteness or blackness, but by the time it filters down to the average person, it comes across like your being white means you are part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a negation of that biblical right of two witnesses saying that I did something wrong. I've already been accused of doing something wrong. And so that would be a conflict, I would think, between biblical justice then and what is called social justice, even if those who proposed it somewhere in the academy or something wouldn't go that far.
Well, I mean, there's a couple overlapping ideas you've got there. One is how do we deal with the collective versus the individual? How does social justice treat that? How does the Bible treat that? And then you're also asking how are these things understood in the academy versus on the street? And I can only deal with the quotations as they come and put them in context. And, you know, again, if we did this with Christianity, the vast majority of people in the public, including most Christians, if you ask them what Christianity teaches, would say something like, well, if you believe in God and you do enough good works, you get to go to heaven when you die. We all know that. And we all believe that's inaccurate. And if we had a chance, we'd sit down with that person and say, no, the Bible teaches X, the Bible teaches. We'd go through details. And that's why when I get into these questions about social justice, I know these discussions happen on the street like that, but all discussions get diffused when you play the telephone game long enough, right? But I want to know what's actually being taught. I'm interested in leadership and how leadership understands these issues and how they enshrine them in their ministries and going forward and teaching people. Social justice, as far as critical race theory, simply does not teach that you don't get witnesses and all that kind of stuff, and that if you have white skin, you are therefore guilty and have to pay reparations. That is a caricature of what it teaches. In fact, the whole discussion of whiteness is not a discussion of essence, of individuals. It is a discussion about the society that was created by white people in the 19th and early 20th century and the lasting effects that has today and how we've, in many cases, unconsciously imbibed that. That doesn't attribute to us individual guilt. It simply shows that we are controlled. We are affected to a large part by our society. And we think we've gotten rid of it. with Jim Crow, with the erasure of Jim Crow and the civil rights movement. And the critical race theory arguments are, no, they haven't. So that when this issue came up earlier about how if there's a disparity, some of these people, they will say, well, if I see a racial disparity, I see racism. And the reason they do that is based on the historical record leading up to that point. Maybe there are other factors involved. And by the way, if you get into Crenshaw and many of these other writers, you'll find out they acknowledge these things. But they also acknowledge that there seems to be this constant doing everything possible to try to find any explanation except race when the historical record shows that it's race, 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 race. And then we just change the language at some point. You know, on the one day we're saying blacks are lazy and hypersexualized and they can't control themselves. And then the next year after the Civil Rights Act passed, the campaign slogan switched to, hey, we need more law and order in minority communities. We all know what they meant by that. And that the racism in many people's minds and the way they were shaped is not gone. And it's impossible to get in there and make an individual accusation of racism in any particular case, because all you got to do is deny it if you don't have evidence. But we all know what's going on. And how do we heal that? And it's one thing to say, yeah, you can change hearts and minds, but I think we need to have larger discussions about how the gospel needs to pervade so that justice rolls down like water and righteousness like streams of water. And, you know, we're far apart on some of these ideas about the concept of whiteness imposing guilt and defining in groups, absolutely defining your character and identity. That's just simply not true. And if people on the street treat it that way, we need to have that discussion in that context and not in the context of people who write books and do scholarships and influence leadership.
Yeah. Scott, one of the things that I think Joel has said and others would say is that the church has done a poor job and really created a boogeyman out of movements like this to sort of maybe maintain the status quo, maybe not have really deal with the issues. What would you say in response to that? I mean, let's be as honest as we can. Have we done a poor job? Has the white church, for example, done a poor job of listening to the stories of others? Is this a are we engaging in a defense mechanism rather than really listening to the other side? Is that possible?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, those things are possible. I probably see this issue a little bit differently in the sense on race anyways. I tend to look at the incredible progress that we've made in this country, you know, in terms of breaking down overt racial discrimination and even attitudes towards race. I see America largely today as one of the least racist countries in the world. And I've traveled to many countries in the world. I can tell you today, they struggle a lot more with racism than the United States does. What we're seeing today is an exacerbation of racial tensions because of this ideology, because it tends to be racially essentialist. And Joel, you know, it's simply not true that these are mischaracterizations. This collective guilt is somehow a mischaracterization of critical social theory. That's the way it's literally working itself out. A couple of examples these aren't fringe examples. This is mainstream stuff. What happened a few years ago in Oberlin, Ohio, you might remember the story of Oberlin College and Gibson's Bakery. And this is one of so many stories like this that are happening now. A young black man from the university comes into this bakery that's run by a white family, shoplifts, and Gibson calls the police, the guy's arrested. Then the next day, all these protesters from the university show up and start protesting against the bakery and claiming that they're guilty of racism, you know, against this black man. It has to fit that narrative because they're white, they're guilty, not the young black man who did the shoplifting, even after he confessed that he had done that wrong thing, you know. And they were labeled racist, and their bakery was basically put out of business on that basis. Or you could take Brett Kavanaugh, you know, that whole situation with him. He had to be assumed of being guilty of gang rape because we have to believe all women because men are oppressors, right? I mean, this kind of collective guilt is like becoming very mainstream right now. And it's not, that's not some fringe characteristic of this movement. That's the way it's working its way out in society right now. Just back to Evan, just briefly, individual group. I thought I really liked that question. And I, you know, the Bible is very powerful, the biblical worldview, when compared to other worldviews, in that it upholds both, right? It says that we are important as individuals, right? You know, God knows our names. He makes us unique. And we are, as unique individuals, can change history, you know. God works through people like, he raises up and works through people like Abraham, right, to carry out his, you know, his redemptive plan as an individual, as a family. But the Bible also upholds the importance of groups. It's not good for man to be alone. God wants us to be involved in families and nations and communities. We're social beings. So there's this beautiful biblical balance between the importance of the individual and the importance of groups that we belong to and how they shape us. Where things go off the rails with so many worldviews is that they begin to overemphasize one at the expense of the other, right? And I would say that critical social justice is definitely going overboard in terms of its overemphasizing kind of community characteristics, group characteristics. The individual is anathema, frankly, to so many people who are pushing this idea. You know, individualism or the individual is something that individual agency, individual choice. They don't appreciate those ideas. So,
Joel, I'm guessing you think that's an overstatement.
There are a lot of things. Going back to the Oberlin example, you'll see just how much critical social justice, as you've described it, influence that situation, because yes, after a group of students did get involved and cause a ruckus, the justice system handled it perfectly and awarded a lawsuit in their favor, and they got several tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars settlement out of it.
Just to correct you, I've been in touch with that family. That has been appealed. That is not settled.
So I was about to finish my statement by saying it has been appealed.
They're not confident they're going to get justice yet. So.
Okay. So I'm before you interrupted me, I was just literally about to say that has been appealed, but the judgment from the trial court has been in their favor. So, I mean, I think you're overstating the influence. And again, this was a bunch of students being in a ruckus. It wasn't some kind of leadership. And it was, in fact, it was a lack of leadership on this issue. So I don't buy all of these examples. And I think when you make these claims like the collective guilt and the guilt, we must believe all women because all men are oppressors and guilty. No critical theorist teaches that stuff. And maybe the media is following that. But again, it falls back on us for not being involved in the discussion. We don't have a seat at the table because we're too busy running for the hills saying this stuff's of the devil. We shouldn't touch it. I'll give you an example of what I mean by the misrepresentations of a specific instance. And you've brought up Ta-Nehisi Coates a couple times, or you've brought up Abram Kendi a couple times. And by the way, I don't even know they would consider themselves critical theorists, but if you want to lump them in a larger discussion, we can have it. There's a quotation you have in along these lines about the moral duty in critical social theory is basically it's if you're white, you're guilty. And you can never repay that guilt. It's eternal penance. I think that's how you characterized it. And you quoted to this regard as proof of that statement from Ta-Nehisi Coates. And it says, quote, when asked about whether reparations would balance the scales of justice for the injustice of slavery, Ta-Nehisi Coates replied that, quote, the country can never fully repay African Americans, end quote. And then you went on to categorize that as eternal penance. But when you pull up Coates's actual article in which he said that, you find out this was not an interview. Nobody asked him about that. He was writing a long article on reparations. He wasn't replying to a question. In reality, the fullness of what he said was this, quote, "Perhaps after a serious discussion and debate, we may find that the country can never fully repay African Americans, but we stand to discover much about ourselves in such a discussion." So in other words, he wasn't making a declaration that it could never be paid. He said nothing about eternal penance. All that he said was, if we found out that it couldn't be paid, we would still learn from the discussion anyway. That's the worldview that I think, that is a worldview in which Christians can actually have a lot of discussion and overlap. And it's nothing like you characterized it. It's in fact, I'm off actually wondering how you got a declarative statement out of that to begin with. But I find it very troubling that we will take a misrepresentation like that and then draw from it a principle, a tenet, if you will, of social justice, allegedly, that they believe in eternal penance. And the only authority for that is this quotation, which says nothing exactly like that. I find that throughout these discussions. I find it throughout the book, and I find it throughout most of the critical books that I've read, actually. And I find that very troubling. And what I'm calling for is Christians to get in there and listen, try hard to understand, and then start to interact and bring what we have to offer to bear on the problems that they're talking about, where it's applicable anyway. So I think we need a much more honest and humble and listening approach than these kind of over-the-top characterizations that scare people. Because honestly, if that's all we're doing, we're going to create the same kind of people on the street as the people you're complaining about on the other side, these people who are uninformed, who are giving halfway ideas is about these things that are over-the-top characterizations, and it's just going to create more heat than light. And I'm very, very interested in more light.
Okay. We have probably gone over the normal amount of time. We usually try to keep podcasts to an hour, but given the importance of this topic, we definitely wanted to go long. Still, I think for the sake of your own time, we should probably draw things to a close. And we said 5-minute closings. So if there's anything that we haven't maybe covered or anything you want to respond to, I want you each to have time to do that now. So for about 5 minutes each. And I guess, Joel, we keep saying you'd go first, so we'll follow that pattern here as well.
Okay. Well, first of all, again, thank you, Evan, and thank you, Scott. I know this is a tense conversation, and that's never comfortable, and I understand it myself. And I try to tell myself I would court these kind of conversations to correct my own views. And I do appreciate the pushback where you give it as well. So yeah, I appreciate you being involved in this. I would simply stick to my opening comments that social justice is simply one aspect of social theory and that Christians need to get involved in it in our overall work of being transformative in the culture. We need to be the number one in the field. We need to get engaged and start working toward that goal. And you're just going to find out that in the process, you're going to rub up against a lot of pagans and pagan ideas. Those ideas don't determine and define what social justice is. You'll find out that you can get in there and do the same thing in the same way you do in every other field. I have... And in fact, I don't think we should be so afraid of doing that with terms like social justice. And I'm going to put a little barb in here and say that Scott actually agrees with me on this topic. When I say we can take a term like that, that is widely used by pagans and dominated by pagans and reappropriate that in a Christian context. And the reason I know that is because on his first page of his first book, where he defines biblical justice and social justice, he defines part of biblical justice with the phrase distributive justice. Now, Scott, I think very rightly went back to the 1828 Webster's Dictionary, where these things were defined very early on for us, and sees that distributive justice means impartiality, rendering judgment, righting wrongs, meeting out punishment for law breaking, reserved for God and God-ordained authorities, including parents, elders, etc. The problem is, that's not what distributive justice is universally meant, understood to mean today in the mainstream culture. Today, as Scott probably well knows, being a former Siderite, that those people, the vast majority of social justice and the vast majority of the world understands distributive justice to mean government welfare redistributions of wealth so that wealth is distributed equally. Well, I would simply urge you, Scott, if you can use distributive justice in your definition of biblical justice, why can't you use social justice the same? It's the exact same principle. But I would go even one step further and say, if we're going to let Marxist influence in things, even Marxism at the origins of things, say that this is a no-go, I would encourage you strongly to get on board with those who say we need to get out of public schools, because there is no more Marxist institution in our society than the public school system. It was designed by Marxists along Marxist lines, and it's the most socialistic wealth transferring institution in the society. So I would encourage you that if you're going to go that direction, be consistent with it and call that out as well. In fact, if you want to read Marx's manifesto, the Communist Manifesto of Marx and Engels, he gives you 10 points where we need to have these major transformations in society, and number, you know, abolition of private property, the centralization of credit in the hand of the state, and all that kind of stuff. Number 10 on that list is free public education, free to all people. That was Marx's baby, and we have it. It's all through our society. So if you want to root out the roots of the Marxist problem, go after the school system and call it out by name. I would simply say that the problem that I deal with here is the same I've dealt with in other places. I simply don't see it from the sources. I see characterizations that you might find an extreme example here or there in society. You might find it from students. I'm talking about people in leadership, people who are trained to preach, teach, and lead. We need to get our minds about what the ideas really say and how they interact with biblical principles of including guilt and corporate guilt and those kinds of things, because there is corporate guilt in the Bible too. Daniel tells us that when he repents on behalf of the entire Israelite nation for something that was done in the generation before him. There's not a conflict there with the Bible if we do it biblically. So I would simply encourage people to get more deeply in the sources. Don't listen to the surface projections by critics. Don't listen to the claims that this is some great boogeyman or a completely antithesis to the faith. Get in, dig in, do your own research. Be critical in the sense that Paul tells us to be critical. And I'll end with this point. Paul tells us to be critical of all things. Being critical is not a bad thing. Being critical doesn't mean you have a harsh, judgmental attitude. It simply means you think through all aspects of an issue before you make a decision. You want to know all the facts and all the principles involved. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 2 that the spiritual person judges all things. And the word in the Greek for judges there is anakrino. It doesn't just simply mean to be a critic. We get our word critic from krino. It doesn't simply mean to think about it. Anakrino means to think twice, or literally, a best translation to the modern English would be to cross-examine in the way that a lawyer cross-examines things. Paul says this is the duty of a Christian, of a spiritual person, and I would simply call people to do that on this issue. Don't listen to the characterization written in books, and some of which are clearly designed just to create propaganda. I'm not saying that about Scott's, but some of them are. And get in, dig into the issues, and start asking, how would Christian leadership assert itself, particularly to the solution of specific problems in society? And when you do that, you know what? If you think I'm wrong, fine. Just do what I'm saying. Don't call it social justice. And when you're done, you can say, I solved a major problem. And I will simply say to you that you have done Christian social justice. And we can disagree on the term. I just want people doing it. I want them in the midst of the fight. I want them engaged with their hands dirty, with their hands on the leper, actually trying to make a change in society. Thank you for letting me go over. I really appreciate that.
Okay, Scott, go ahead. 6.5 minutes instead of 5.
Okay.
It's going to be totally equal time, but yeah.
Sure thing. Yeah. Thank you, Joel. And thank you, Evan. It's been good to be involved in this dialogue as well. When I think of people that are influencing the culture right now on these issues, I think of people like Ta-Nehisi Coates, Ibram X. Kendi, Robin DiAngelo, I wouldn't consider these to be outliers or just students. These are leaders. And I would encourage everyone to read their books, listen to what they're saying, And then you can decide whether you think I'm mischaracterizing their arguments or creating some kind of a straw man, as Joel is suggesting that I am. I'm genuinely not. I'm trying to understand what they're saying, and I'm trying to be humble and listen and understand where they're coming from. What are these ideas? They say that they stand for social justice, and that phrase social justice, again, is never found in the Bible. That couplet, again, it has its sources in Catholic and specifically in Jesuit teachings going back to the 1800s. And that's why I'm not particularly invested in it. I am in the biblical concept of justice. And that's ground that we can never cede. That's our home turf, if you will. The real problem that I am trying to address in my book and why I'm concerned about this is that Christians are being deceived right now. They're confusing non-biblical understandings of justice for biblical ones. And they're doing this because of all of the non-biblical baggage that's being loaded into phrases like social justice. These Christians need to understand and to recognize and abandon this counterfeit and uphold the original biblical justice. I commend them. Most of them are young and they want to do what's right. They want to care for the oppressed and the vulnerable. They want to stand up for Black lives. They want to stand against racism and injustice. This is all good. This is wonderful. We all want that. But what they, I'm afraid, don't see is the Trojan horse. That is the way that this ideology is being marketed as social justice and using words like inclusion and diversity and equity, which often mean, as you dig into it, just the opposite of what they're saying. So it's a profoundly unbiblical ideology. It's tearing our society apart. It's tearing churches apart. It's ripping families apart. It's bearing horrible fruit in our society. Grievance over gratitude, hostility, tribalism, conflict, cancel culture, increased racial tension. In conclusion, I just believe that the church has to fight to uphold biblical justice. We have to understand, however, that that couplet, social justice, has been hijacked by non-Christians. They've successfully redefined it in the broader culture as their preferred brand, and now they've put it in service as a label over a deeply unbiblical ideology and movement. Clarity is vital in this time of great deception. So for clarity's sake, I simply say we as Christians should stand for justice or biblical justice and not confuse others by saying that we stand for social justice. Thank you.
Well, thank you both. Appreciate all of your time. We probably all need to find the bathroom or something. At some point, we've gone on for so long with no commercial breaks or anything, but I want to thank you both for your time. Where can people find you? Scott, the name of your book again is Why Social Justice is Not Biblical Justice, easily findable on Amazon. And I believe the same is true for Joel McDermott's book, The Problem of Slavery in Christian America, not to mention other titles. I've read many of them myself. And again, Lamb's Reign is a blog and a website where I think Joel will blog from time to time. He will be, if all goes according to plan, in a couple years. A lawyer. So if you find yourself in need of criminal defense, or maybe on the wrong
Let's
side,
hope not.
hopefully not. But hey, sometimes we're victims, of overzealous prosecutors and whatnot. We'll need a good criminal defense attorney. Anyway, you'll be able to find both these guys. I want to thank them for their time. And I'm Evan McClanahan. I'm the pastor at First Lutheran. This is Theology on Tap. Of course, HoustonTOT.com is where to find us. HoustonTOT. Check us out, all of our local events, the podcast, rate us, subscribe. We appreciate all that kind of stuff so we can bring you more conversations like this. And until next time, we encourage you to question freely, think deeply, and disagree as needed.